The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Super Bowl Sunday night. I hope you're enjoying the game, but I hope you're enjoying this special edition of Sports Talk 1240 tonight. It's only the Super Bowl, folks. There's another one next year, so turn down the sound, stay with us, and enjoy the show tonight. It's a special edition. I think you're going to enjoy the rest of the show. My next guest is a Bronx native. Played his college ball at DePaul, where he was awarded All-American honors. He then enjoyed a long career in the NBA, playing from 1988 to 2005. He's presently an assistant coach for the University of South Florida Bulls. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Rod Strickland. Rod, good evening.
How you doing?
Great to have you with us.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me.
Well, at DePaul as a junior, your first team All-American, averaging 20 points a game and 7.8 assists. Not too bad.
Not too bad. 7.8 assists. I didn't know I was that many. You might have gave me a couple.
And 87-88 All-America pick. You helped the Blue Demons to four straight NCAA tournament appearances, including Sweet 16's showings in 86 and 87. You rank among the program's career leaders in scoring, which is tremendous. Also averaged 3.4 rebounds, shooting 53.4% during your college career. How'd you like it at DePaul?
I enjoyed it. It was a great experience. DePaul was one of those schools I looked at all the time, and really, honestly, they didn't have to do a whole lot of recruitment of me. I was a big DePaul fan. You know, I enjoyed watching them play. They was on TV a lot, and I wanted to be on TV, and I loved the way they played. So they really didn't have to recruit me much. I really had my mind set on going to DePaul.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Now, everybody around here remembers you with the Knicks, of course. Now, you were selected in the first round of the 88 draft. By the hometown club, you backed up Mark Jackson, who was the 88 Rookie of the Year. People thought it was kind of odd that the Knicks took you because they already had Jackson. Now, you shared time with Mark that season. You played in all 88 games. You had a good year, named to the NBA All Rookie Second Team. You got to play with some good guys, though. Give us your impression of Patrick Ewing.
I enjoyed everybody on that team. That was a great team. It was a young team. It was a fun team. We played a fun style of play with Rick Pitino. But Pat was great. You know, Pat was the soldier. He was the leader. He was the guy who wanted the ball and wanted to make the big play. And, you know, everybody kind of fell in line around him. He was, you know, obviously all-time great, you know, Hall of Famer. You know, he was the catalyst to that team.
Definitely, yeah. And also Rick Pitino. Now, he didn't spend a great deal of time here, but everybody knows him as a great coach wherever he went. Give us your impression of Rick Pitino, Rod.
Yes, well, he definitely was a great coach, very intense. You know, he loved the up-tempo style. You know, I was not a three-point shooter in my career. That was one year that I shot three-pointers a lot, you know, because that's what Coach Pitino, you know, he didn't like the long twos. So we shot a lot of threes, up-tempo style. We pressed. You know, we had a young, energetic team. So it was great. I mean, it was a fun, exciting time in the Garden playing with the team.
Yeah, well, it was bombs away. Was Trent Tucker on that club?
Yes, Trent Tucker, yeah. Johnny Newman, Gerald Wilkins, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, they ended up trading you to San Antonio. Now, you really flourished in San Antonio, and Larry Brown was the coach down there. Tell us about your impression on getting sent down to San Antonio.
Well, it was exciting. You know, they had a young up-and-coming team with with Dave Robinson and Sean Elliott, Willie Anderson, and they had veterans, you know, like Terry Cummins. So it was great, you know. I mean, it was a great atmosphere in San Antonio. The fans were great. It was a good experience.
And you got to play with another Hall of Famer in David Robinson.
Yes, yes. And Dave is a special, you know, that guy, 7 foot tall, run like a deer. You know, mm-hmm. he could run me down on a fast break. I mean, he was that athletic. And defensively, you know, and Pat Ewing was a great defender, obviously, a great shot blocker. But David Robinson covered a lot more space. And that's saying a lot because Pat was great.
Right. How about the system of Larry Brown?
Oh, it was good. You know, Coach Brown let you play. Coach Brown's a little different now because Coach, you know, he was a point guard and he could be hard sometimes and want you to play a certain way. And but he was great. He's Hall of Famer coach.
Right.
He was great to play for. You know, we had our little tiffs probably about, you know, some things on the court, but he was great. I loved playing for him.
Now, did Portland, you sign as a free agent in Portland?
Yes, yes.
Now, how did you feel about playing up in Portland?
Portland was great. It was another place, another great atmosphere. We had a great team. You know, I remember going to Portland, and I actually was coming off the bench, and our bench players were me, Mario, Eli, and Cliff Robinson, which, you know, that was great for your first three guys coming off the bench. And you had Terry Porter, Clyde Drexler, Jerome Kersey, Kevin Duckworth, and Buck Williams starting.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember us getting off to a great start. I don't know, I think we started off 8-0. And this was coming off their second loss in the championship.
Right.
I think it was to Detroit. But, you know, we was off to a great start, and then Clyde Drexler got hurt. And that kind of changed the whole dynamics of the team. You know, we wound up having good years and had a good season, but, you know, I think if Clyde didn't get hurt, we had a chance to have a special year.
Right. after that, you went to Washington. You had Juwan Howard, Chris Webber. You really enjoyed the best season of your career in 97-98. You averaged 17.8 points, 10.5 assists per game.
Yes. Yes, that was another experience. I got a chance to play with some younger guys, some young up-and-coming guys, and Chris and Juwan, Calvin Cheney, and that was a great time. Playing with Chris Webber, and I'll never forget. You know, we ran a lot of pick and rolls, and it was great playing with Chris Webber because all you had to do was put the ball somewhere, he was catching it. You know, he had great hands, he could finish. He was a special player. You know, he could score, rebound, assist, steals. I mean, he did it all. So it was kind of special playing with him.
Mm-hmm. During that year, Rod, also, we're talking to Rod Strickland tonight. You became the 25th player, the 25th player in NBA history to record 10,000 points and 5,000 assists, which is pretty good.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a nice feat. You know, I was happy to be a part of that. You know, I've been playing ball so long, so it's always good to get some accolades as you go along. So that was good. That was good.
Now, you got upset that you weren't selected to play in the All-Star game. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you
regret that, or do you still feel that you should have been selected?
No, I mean, you know, when you're young.
Yeah, that's what I figured, yeah.
Things happen. But, you know, honestly, I was upset and still feel a little certain kind of way about it. Not
yeah.
upset, but, you know, I thought there was years that I could have made the All-Star team. And, you know, like I said, I was young, competitive. You know, that's something that you really want, you know. As
sure, why not? Yeah, exactly.
You're one of the best players and you're striving for that. And then when you don't get it, it's disappointing. So
exactly.
I think I was just lashing out as a young player, but it was more because I was frustrated. I thought I deserved it, and I didn't get it. But I mean, it is what it is, and you know, I played 17 years in the NBA. I've been blessed. You know what I mean? So it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, I hear you. And you went on to Miami after that, Rod. you got to play for Pat Riley. Give us your impression of playing for Pat.
Well, Pat Riley's a special coach, special person. You know, I'll never forget going there. I went there late. I wasn't there from the beginning of training camp. I remember getting there late. But I remember us starting out, I think we were like 0-11 or 0-12 or something like that. And I just remember Pat Riley was determined that, you know, no one was giving up on him. And I remember those practices. They were hard. I remember his conversations before practice and after practice. He challenged us every day. Pat Riley's a soldier. Like, I wish I could have played for him more years. You know, I had a chance to play for him that one year, and I know he's hard and you know, he wants things done a certain way. But I enjoy Pat Riley. And we actually turned it around, and we made a nice push for the playoffs, but we fell short at the end. We just got worn down. But I enjoyed, like, I enjoyed big time playing for Pat Riley.
Yeah. And you crossed paths with another Hall of Famer in Alonzo Mourning.
Yeah, Alonzo, I always tell people this about Alonzo Mourning. Like, he's one of my favorite players that I play with, because this guy is an all-star, Hall of Famer, all-time great. And we started out 0-12, and he was having his physical problems at that time. You know, he was trying to overcome that. But I remember him never saying a negative word ever. You know, as we went and we struggled, he was always that guy working hard, encouraging everybody. Like, he never turned his back on any. You know how you get sometimes, these guys, you know, I need help, I need this, I need that.
Yeah.
He never turned his back on his teammates. You know, he kept trying to pump everybody up. He kept plugging away. And that's one of the reasons why we had it, where we turned it around and had an opportunity to almost make the playoffs. And it was all because of his leadership.
Definitely. Talking to Rod Strickland tonight. Your next stop, Rod, was up in Minnesota. And you got to play with Kevin Garnett, a guy who's still doing it in the NBA.
Yes, and that's another one of my favorite teammates. Like, he's up there with Zoe. He was an intense guy, hardest worker, one of the funniest guys. You know, everybody sees a scowl on his face and on the court,
yeah,
Jawing at everybody, but he's one of the most naturally funny guys you'll ever be around. And one thing I remember, and nothing to do with basketball, but I remember how he treated the young guys on the team. You know, he always tried to help them out. He always tried to take care of them. He always tried to keep them in line and make sure they were right. Like, and I just thought that was big time, you know, because he didn't have to do that. And I don't know how many guys do that, but he took care of his young guys on that team. And I respected that.
And you'll always remember that, definitely. Yeah, that's a great thing to remember.
Cool.
And in Orlando.
And as far as play, I'm sorry, but as far as playing, he was just an ultra competitive guy. You know, I remember us being in the huddle and, you know, Flip Saunders maybe trying to run a play. And I remember him just putting his hand across the board and reaching the play, like, just give the ball to the ticket.
Yeah.
Give it to the ticket. So he was great to play. Great to play.
Sure. In Orlando, you have another coach, another great coach, Doc Rivers. And T-Mac also playing down there with you.
Well, actually, I didn't get a chance, and I wish I would have, but I didn't get a chance to play with Doc Rivers.
Okay.
Johnny Davis was the head coach.
Okay.
And the team, you know, the team wasn't that good. The team was really kind of bad.
No.
That was a good experience, but, it's, you know, when you're losing as much as we were losing in Orlando, you know, it's hard to create any great memories from that, you know, not knocking it at all, but I mean, it was a good experience. Obviously, I was playing, which I was older at that point, so to be able to extend my career was great. But it was a tough year, and after a while, I think I got there late. I got there into the season, so they were already struggling. You know, once I got there, we played a little better, but struggled, and then they turned to start playing the younger guys. And then I went to Toronto during that season. You know, at the end of the season, I wound up getting out of my contract and going to Toronto.
Yeah, how'd you feel about going up to Toronto, Rod?
Toronto was good. I mean, another good experience, but, you know, that was later in my career. So that was kind of the time where I was bouncing around, and, you know, the teams were either not good or like in the middle or last in the playoff run. So, you know, and going to Toronto was a funny situation because when I went there, everybody was hurt. So I thought I would have the opportunity to play and maybe make a push. And the funny thing is I went there, I'll never forget the first game, because actually Jalen Rose was there, he was hurt.
Right.
Alvin Williams was there, he was hurt. So I go to Toronto, and the first game in Toronto, we play in Indiana, and I get 17 assists, and we win the game. And when by the time we came back from Indiana, they were not injured anymore. We're now playing. So
yeah.
Once they started playing, that kind of put me back in the lineup. So, you know, it's just one of those situations.
And your final stop was Houston.
Yeah. Not too many finals of Houston. You know, that was kind of, and nothing against Houston. That's just by then. And, you know, as your career is over with, you can look back at it. By the time I got to Houston, I was over with as far as the player. You know,
you had
legs
it, yeah.
gone. You know, legs gone. You know, I still thought I could play, still wanted to play, still was fighting to play. Didn't really play that much, you know, up and down, struggled a little bit. And then I wound up getting cut. I'll never forget getting the voicemail that I was cut from Houston. So, you know.
Who left that for
was,
you?
That was the ending.
Jeff Van Gundy. Jeff Van Gundy, yeah.
Yeah.
Not good.
Not good. Well, I mean, looking back at it, it's what was supposed to happen. You know, at that particular time, it wasn't good.
Yeah. So from then, what did you do after that? You went right to coaching, or what did you do after you left Houston?
Yeah, well, after I got cut, which was, I think you said 2005 it was, and I think that was in January or February. So from that point on, you know, I was trying to find something to do. I almost went overseas. Actually, I committed to playing with Arvydas Sabonis' team. And I forgot where it was at, but I was supposed to go there. I had my bags packed, and that morning I was supposed to leave. I backed out of it. You know, my kids were leaving for school. They were crying. They didn't want me to leave.
Yeah.
So by the time I woke up, I changed my mind, and I never left. You know, I wanted to play basketball so bad. I still wanted to play that. I even thought about playing in Puerto Rico. But then after I thought about it, I just couldn't do that. And so, you know, I was done playing basketball. I didn't officially retire, but I was trying to figure out something to do because, you know, I don't think people understand, you know, you play basketball all your life and then all of a sudden it's cut off and there's no going back to basketball. You know, if you got a regular job, you know, you might try to find a next job. You know, you can physically do it.
Well, right.
In basketball, when it's over, it's over. You can't physically do it anymore.
No. Yeah, so, exactly.
So there's not like this jump to something familiar. So, you know, I thought about it. I put some feelers out there. And I wound up in Memphis with Coach Cal. You know, he gave me the opportunity, I was grateful for that opportunity. I don't know how many, especially at that time, you know, NBA players really didn't think a college job, you know, that they weren't taking college jobs. You know, Danny Manning was there. Most NBA guys didn't take a college job, you know. So I wound up taking a job and being in a great situation, being with John Calipari. And you know, here I am, 9 years later, 8 years later.
That's not too bad, though. We're talking to Rod Strickland tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Give us your impression of working for Calipari.
Well, it was great. You know, I've 3 years in Memphis with him and 5 years at Kentucky. I was with him for 8 years. You know, I was able to be around some of the greatest college players and some of the great pros of now.
Right.
And then I was able to learn from a future Hall of Fame coach and at a high level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's priceless for me to be able to 17 years in the NBA and then jump into a college experience with John Calipari. I mean, you just don't get that. Like, it doesn't happen a lot. So
right.
I kind of got lucky and fortunate that I was able to be in that situation. And it's just helped me grow more and more as a coach, you know, as a person, you know, dealing with kids, as a teacher. You know, it's been a great experience.
Do you wish you would have stuck around in New York a little more, Rod?
Absolutely. I think about that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you know, things happen for a reason, and I was feisty, you know, and I was competitive. And me and Mark, just if it was nowadays, the way they play, me and Mark would have been great together in New York.
Yeah.
Because if you just think about it now, if it was this era and this time, teams would have played us together. Back then, to play two point guards, you know, 6'2", 6'3", you know, they wasn't really doing that. You know, you had your point guard, you had your two guard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but these days now, you know, you'll put two point guards together with no problem.
Right.
It's funny because the times in New York when me and Mark played together, the little bit of times when Coach put us in there, we played well together, but he wouldn't do it. I mean, it just wasn't the thing there. But now they probably would have. But yeah, I would have loved to stay in New York more. And actually, I tried to go back there. The funny thing is, when Mark went back there, I was talking to them as well. But Mark wound up going back to play for them. So, yeah, I do. You know, when you look back at things and retrospect, you know, there's certain things you probably wish you would have done differently, would have went this way or that way. And, you know, sometimes it's the luck of the draw and sometimes it's circumstances.
Yeah, that's tough. Now, September 2008, you were inducted into the New York City Basketball Hall of Fame. That's not too bad. You went in with Kenny Anderson, Sam Perkins, Pete Gillen, Lou Bender, and Eddie Younger. Tell us about that experience.
It was great, you know, being able to sit there and definitely being there with Kenny Anderson, you know, who's a friend of mine. And it's funny because, you know, he was in high school and I was in the league, but, you know, not that much in front of him. And I remember me and Mark Jackson just always watching him play and talking about him. You know, so to be able to go in there with Kenny was good, you know.
Yeah.
But just, you know, being from New York City, you know, born and raised, to be a part of that, to be thought of as one of the best to ever come out of New York, you know, with so many great players and legends and all that. It was an honor, you know. I felt good about that.
Who were some of the toughest guys that you went up against?
Man, I get asked that question all the time, and it's so many. But the number one guy, because I played against him probably more in playoffs, Kevin Johnson was tough. You know,
yeah.
But then you had Tim Hardaway, you had Gary Payton, you know, had Isaiah Thomas, had Magic Johnson. You know, you had Mark Price. There's so many. I know John Stockton. Then you had tough defensive guys like Derek Harper. And Greg Anthony was one of the tougher defenders to go up against. You know, so there was so many guys. There was so many. I think night in and night out, you know, you had to be ready. You know, I remember Nate McMillan in Seattle. And he's not known as one of the great. He was tough to play against.
How about of all the coaches that you played for? Who was the one that stands out?
Well, I'll have to say this: Rick Adelman, he helped me grow in my game. I flourished with him because once I went to Portland, once I went to Portland, he opened up the game for me so much more. Like he had me coming off the screen, he had me posting up, you know, as well as handling the ball. So he kind of gave my game a kind of roundness and, you know, well-rounded, and I was able to do a lot more. And he put me in a lot more positions to succeed. And he also is one of those coaches who just let you play. You know, not a lot of restraints, you know, as long as you play the right way. You know, I'll never forget playing a playoff game in Houston and struggling and him pulling me to the side and telling me, you keep going, don't stop shooting, you keep playing. You know, so that type of motivation, you know, I think it really kick-started me from being the player I became, or Portland. You know, I love playing for Bernie Bickerstaff. You know, Coach Brown, we had our struggles and everything, but great coach. I enjoyed playing for Rick Pitino. Pat Riley, like I said, was great. Flip Saunders was great to play for. So there was a lot of paths that I crossed, and I've learned a lot from them. you know, different personalities, different styles, different ways of dealing with people and players. So,
a lot of guys I talked to, Rod, say Rick Adelman. They really enjoyed playing for him. It's funny that you mentioned him. A lot of guys that I've had on the show mentioned Rick.
Yeah, but you know what's funny? And to this day, I don't even know if he knows. I don't even know if my family knows. But when Rick Adelman called me and told me he got fired, and when I got off the phone with him, I cried.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I'm, you know, because I just felt it was like, wow. You know, because he had done so much for my career. You know, and I was kind of shocked that they fired him, you know. But I'll never forget that. Like, it was emotional when they fired him.
It happens to the best of them. That's the deal. What's a day like today for you down at USF, Rod?
Just like for the last 8 years, you know, you get up in the morning, get to the office, 8:30, 9 o'clock, make some phone calls, watch a lot of video. Meet about today's practice, then practice, then after practice, go to my son's practice or my son's games, get home and watch some more film, watch some basketball on TV. You know, that's for the most part, those are my days. That's my day.
Yeah. You do any recruiting for USF?
Yes. Also recruiting. How could I forget that? But that's part of the phone calls.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. We're on the road, and we're on the road now heavy trying to recruit, but definitely that's part of it.
Yeah. What do you see yourself doing down the road?
Well, I want to be a head coach in college. You know, that's my goal. That's been the goal since I stepped foot in college basketball. So I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to maybe one day down the road run my own program. You know, I also, I wouldn't mind, you know, NBA. I wouldn't mind, you know, in front office or, you know, it's just so many things. I don't want to limit myself, but I would love to be a head coach in college basketball.
That'd be great. Well, I tell you, Rod, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight, talking about your great NBA career and all the great ball players that crossed your path. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to share it with us. And appreciate your time. Rod Strickland, folks.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll welcome in the great former member of the Moody Blues and Wings to Sports Talk 1240. The legendary Denny Lane will join us. Stay right there, friends.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WDBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA, or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip change. Use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York. Breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
Well, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Super Bowl Sunday. Hope you're enjoying this special edition of Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Last I checked, I'm going to check again for you loyal listeners that have stayed with me. Seattle leads 24-14 over the New England Patriots in the fourth quarter. Darrell Revis just got burned for a touchdown, and then I think Darrell Revis got burned verbally by Richard Sherman. So that's the latest that I have for you. Not sure if Denny Lane is with us or not. No? We're going to take a break? We'll be back right after this, folks. Stay with us.
WGBB has time slots available for anyone who wants to host their own radio show. 516-623-1240. You've probably just asked yourself, well, what kind of show could I do? Well, let me ask you, what are you passionate about? Is it books, cooking, music? How about health and wellness? Or maybe you enjoy learning and talking about history, current events. Interview others in their related fields. 516-623-1240. You can host a show at a station that's been a part of our community for over 80 years, and our knowledgeable staff will be more than happy to assist you. Be heard on the internet, www.am1240wgbb.com. So what do you say? I say call Jeff or Trevor, 516-623-1240. Be the producer. Host your own radio program, 516-623-1240. WGBB, the station that serves your community.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I don't know how to talk like a parent. Don't make me come back there. You see what I mean? It's pretty awful. Try it again. Don't make me come back there. Now that's pretty good. That one kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to put up with you. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue back with you. My next guest, he's a native of Birmingham, in the West Midlands of England, singer, songwriter, and guitarist. He was an original member of the Moody Blues, singing the band's first hit, Go Now, in 1964. He's a member of Wings with Paul McCartney from 1971 to 1981. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Denny Lane. Denny, good evening.
How you doing, Bill? How are you? Good.
It's great to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Now, you were influenced, Denny, as a boy by the legendary Django Reinhardt. He's been an inspiration to many, including Jimmy McCullough, Jeff Beck, Jerry Garcia, Dickie Betts. Dickie Betts dedicated Jessica to him in that movie Swing Kids, Arvid. He had his hand damaged by the Nazis.
Right.
He dedicated his self to Django. His inspiration to keep playing was Django. Talk a little bit about Django Reinhardt.
Well, the thing was that when I was a kid, I was kind of exposed to jazz, Irish music, reggae. Birmingham was a working factory town, and we had a lot of different influences music-wise. And my dad, who came, a long distance past, came from a gypsy background, but he didn't live that lifestyle. But we're all into that kind of music. I lived in Spain for a while, for example, and studied, but hung out with the gypsies out there, and I learned a lot of flamenco music. So that was kind of my, you know, instinct. But it was a friend at school whose brother was a jazz guitarist who actually turned me on to jazz guitar, in the sense that, you know, I had someone I could learn. I had to learn a few chords and actually to tune the guitar, because I started out really playing skiffle, and that was a copy. Knockoff, really. Yeah, that was a knockoff of American music, really.
Right. Now, you were with the Moody Blues during the Decca days, the Magnificent Moodies. You left the band. Talk a little bit about the Moody Blues days.
Well, again, it was a situation where I was doing quite well with my own band in Birmingham, and I wanted to move to London. There was no business. There was no, you know, music business in Birmingham at that time. And I wanted to get them to all move down to London. And but they didn't want to. They all had jobs. So anyway, Mike and Ray came back from Germany, where they'd seen the Beatles at the Star Club in Hamburg. They came back to England and wanted to put a band together to go back to Hamburg, because they knew there was work out there. Well, I said, well, yeah, but let's get the band together. I just want to do kind of mainly blues R&B stuff, and then we'll see how it goes. Well, as it turned out, we got discovered, and we moved down to London anyway. So that was really the beginning. And then we got a job at the Marquee Club, which was a big blues-based thing. We backed people like Sonny Boy Williamson, and they came over. We were pretty big in France. And then we had the hit on the Chuck Berry tour. You know, we closed the first half on the Chuck Berry tour. And that was with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker opening up as the Graham Bond Organization. And we kind of had a hit, and so we went from there. So the rest is history, as they say.
Sure, you know. Now, you started the Electric String Band in 1966. And yeah. It's sort of a sound that ELO would attempt later on. You shared a bill with Hendrix and Procol Harum at the Savile Theater.
Right. Well, Brian Epstein owned that theater. And at that time, just before I left the Moody's, we'd signed to Brian, because, you know, we all were with another company, and they all ripped us off. So we went off with Brian. And we did the Beatles second British tour, so we're friends with all the guys there. And so anyway, I put this band together. It was kind of based, you know, originally in Birmingham. I did get together with Trevor Burton from The Move and Steve Gibbons and a few people, and we went to a little cottage in Wales, south of England, and we were going to put something together like ELO. In fact, it was the beginning of ELO, but then I left, Steve left, and Trevor went off, and then eventually the other guys, you know, got together with Jeff Lynne, and that became ELO, because the original drummer from my band in the Diplomats was Bev Bevan, who was the founding drummer of ELO. So we all come from the same background, and we all bounced off of each other. We all stole ideas, and that's the way it came about, really. So I just did that, my version of that, you know.
Right.
Except mine was a little bit more sort of folky, folk rock. Well, folk blues influenced, I would say, with strings, you know.
You also played with Ginger Baker and Ginger Baker's Air Force with guys like Stevie Winwood and Alan White.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that project.
Well, again, Ginger was my friend, as I said, right from the early days, the Chuck Berry tour. I got to know all of those guys. I got to know Eric and Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck at the Marquee Club, because we all used to do the same gigs, you know. So, I mean, I was part of that crowd. And Trevor Burton and I, Trevor from The Moves, I said, we went down to visit Steve and Traffic. We used to hang around with those people, and when we were sort of, you know, in between gigs, if you like. And then Blind Faith fell flat, so we ended up, Ginger came round to a party at our house and asked us if we wanted to put a band together. So I kind of dragged Alan in and Trevor, because I'd put a band together with them called Balls, and we weren't doing too much work. But, you know, we pulled the two guys into the Ginger Baker's thing. But Ginger Baker's thing was a huge, big band, and, you know, it lasted a little while. But, you know, it was gonna take a long time before that got off the ground in a big way. So, again, you know, Ginger went away to have a little bit of rehabilitation, and that fell on his face. But other than that, you know, all these people are my friends, is what I'm saying. So mm-hmm. we, again, you tend to work with people who you know.
Right.
That's what happened with Paul. I mean, that's exactly what happened with Paul.
You know? Right. So along comes Paul.
Yeah.
He wants to put together a band. You're doing your own album, and he wants to put together a band. So what do you say?
Well, he had seen me at that Jimi Hendrix show. In fact, I went out with Paul in London one night to see Jimmy for the first time at the Bag of Nails Club. Because Chaz Chandler, who's a friend of mine too, he brought him over from America and you know, invited all his pals down. So I went with Paul to see Jimmy. So, you know, it was kind of how all that came about. And then when I was playing at the Savile Theatre that night, Peter Asher is a very close friend of mine now. In fact, to this day, I'm still working with Peter and his band right now. I'm going on tour with him next week.
Okay.
Peter Asher and Paul and John Lennon were in the box there watching us. And it was about 6 months after that I got the call from Paul. I think because he knew me and he knew I was trying to do something different and there's no way we could follow the Beatles or the Moody Blues by doing that stuff. So we went in a completely different direction. And I think he wanted somebody who was willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, he puts together Wings. Do you know where he got the name Wings from, Denny?
No, not really.
You don't?
I heard, but I've forgotten how he got it. I thought he got it from the fan club originally, but they were sending names in the fan club. I think Yeah, I heard another story. I don't remember it.
So supposedly he was at the hospital when Linda was giving birth to Stella. And
that's right.
Now yeah. And he was praying fervently, and the image of Wings came to his mind.
Oh.
So he decided to name his new band Wings.
That makes sense. Well.
Who knows? Right. We have to ask him next time we see him.
He never told me that story. Yeah.
he never told me either, but, you know, who knows? But that's right. What I looked up, and that's what I found. But who neither one of us know. Now, who knows? But we'll talk a little bit about the personnel when we started out. Now, the first record really got a poor review. Now the new band Henry McCullough. You guys were just touring around in a van, correct?
Yeah, well it wasn't as simple as that. I mean, the fact was that I got Henry in the band because I was friends with Joe Cocker's producer, who was Denny Cordell. He produced the first Moody Blues album that I was on. And Denny Cordell and they were having a rehearsal just around the corner from my office in the West End of London. And I went to the rehearsal and, you know, I'd seen them before, met them before, but anyway, I was talking to Henry and a bit later, I heard that he'd left the band or he was leaving the band, and I gave him a call, and so I got him in. I met Denny Sowell on the plane on the way to Scotland for the first time when I got the call from Paul, and he'd done the Ram album, so that was that band. But in actual fact, the band was really good, but we didn't have any material, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was we put the album together very quickly, and that's... A lot of people like that album now. It's the old story that I think they were expecting, like, you know, a big production job, which we just purposely didn't do, you know. We didn't want to be under that scrutiny, right?
I think they were looking for Beatles numbers maybe, too.
Well, they're not getting it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the whole point. You know, we decided that's what we wanted to do, and that's what the best way that we would feel comfortable. But I don't want to be in a band playing Beatles songs. Christ, you know. I used to be in a cover band in Birmingham. That's the way I look at it.
There already was a band playing Beatles numbers. Right?
Yeah. So, the thing was that, that first album was thrown together quickly. But we ended up going on the road purely to get, you know, some experience as a band to play, to get tight, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we took the van. And we just turned up at universities and, you know, they told the roadies told them that we were in the van and we wanted to play. And there was already an audience there because of the campuses, you know. So that's the way we sort of got tight as a band. And that way, then we had, you know, a better situation in the studio next time round when we did Red Rose Speedway. So, you know, it kind of built from there. But, hey, you know, we proved our point. If we'd have done what everybody thought we were going to do, we probably wouldn't have done so well, you know.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Well, you had the singles give Ireland back to the Irish. People didn't like that. The BBC,
no.
Yeah, they really didn't appreciate that.
No.
And then they didn't appreciate Mary Had a Little Lamb. They didn't appreciate that either. And then they didn't appreciate High, High, High. I mean, what did these people want?
Well, look, you know, that's Paul's material. He wrote those songs.
Right.
I just play star on them. That's the way I look at them. But no, yeah, we had a couple of problems with the Irish thing because, hey, that was a political thing. You know?
Right.
I remember having a problem at one of the universities, but there was a little bit of a situation where they were trying to stop us getting, you know, just to confront us with, like, you know, like, just to give us a hard time. But anyway, that, again, the high thing was just the BBC didn't want to play it. You know,
right.
The connotations of it being that. And the Mary Had a Little Lamb, again, Paul just being Paul. You know, I mean, he did an album of his own up in Scotland, and it was all very kind of, you know, lovey-dovey and family-oriented. And so that's what this was. So what? To me, it was just another song, you know. We had plenty of other stuff, and that spoke for itself. So I'm not sort of into the negative of,
no.
of what the public is into, if you know what I mean. You know, because we just do our thing, and then they can think what the hell they like, really. That's all I see.
Well, the Red Rose Speedway hit well, and then after that, the Live and Let Die came along, which was a wonderful success. And after that, one of the most successful albums of all time, Band on the Run, which was amazing.
Well, you know, I actually go out with Peter Ash's band, and I do a couple of regular gigs, and I play albums. I do albums, and the album that I've started to do is the Band on the Run album because it's one that's most closest to my heart because it was just me and Paul that did it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes down really well, you know. People like that album. Don't ask me why. It was just something about it. I mean, I think it was just that we got together in Africa. We didn't have any real plans. I mean, the band was supposed to come and they didn't turn up. And then the tapes were stolen by some thieves that, you know, near the house that we stayed in. And the original rehearsal tapes, is what I'm saying, were stolen.
Uh-huh.
So we just had to start from scratch, Paul on drums, me on guitar, and we just put it together like that. So it came together pretty easily, but it was just something about it. It had its own little sound, its own little feel. I think that's what the appeal was, you know. Otherwise, it's very difficult to be a judge of your own stuff. I think, you know.
Yeah, well, you guys certainly got it right on that one. It's timeless, yeah. Even when he plays it today, it goes over brilliantly.
Yeah, it does, isn't it?
Yeah. Brill, as they say.
Yeah.
And the Venus and Mars, those sessions and the... The other stuff, talk
very
about,
fun.
Yeah.
Well, Venus and Mars, for example, is where we found Joe English, you know, and he came, did the world tour with us, and he was an amazing drummer and singer and just a nice kind of guy, you know, really easygoing and very talented. And so that whole thing of being in New Orleans gave us that atmosphere, you know, that we hung out with Alan Toussaint and Marshall Seahorn at a studio down there called Seahorn Studios, and the Meters and all those people that did all Alan Toussaint's records, you know, they were the in-house studio band, and all those the New Orleans sound, they were just the Aaron Neville and all his brothers.
Mm-hmm.
We met all these guys. So we were influenced by that very much so on that album. And then the other one, of course, is, London Town started to be a band album before that. That was done on a boat, on a couple of boats out in the Virgin Islands. So it was another whole atmosphere that we worked under. And then the other guys left, and then we ended up finishing that one off ourselves in London. So, you know, it depends where you do the albums, I think. And if you have different personalities, it takes on a whole different personality. That's the way it goes, you know.
Talk a little bit, Denny. We're speaking to Denny Lane from Wings and from the Moody Blues and just a legend of rock and roll. The great Mullikintyre.
Well, now, a lot of people in this country weren't really exposed to that song.
No,
well,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, because it was, I think Paul felt it was not really an American star single. Although it was huge in England, that was because of the Scottish roots to it.
And now, Denny, excuse me, wasn't that the number one selling UK single
of all time,
yeah. Correct?
Yeah, before they did We Are the World, which is basically the English version of...
non-charity, the number one non-charity.
Yeah, the only number one charity, yeah, the biggest one.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, that was we living in Scotland. I went over to Paul's. I was staying in one of the cottages on the land up there. I went over to his house, and he'd already got the chorus, you know. I said, well, that could be a huge song, you know. If the Scottish people don't, you know, give us half the time. Because you've got to be very careful doing stuff like that. You know, the locals think, hey, what are you doing, you know, trying to mess around with our music.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But anyway, we went out the next day, we wrote the rest of the song, and then we got the Campbelltown Pipe Band in, who were real characters. That was a good laugh. And then we recorded them outdoors, you know. And that got the whole echoes from the mountains and everything. That was a really good session. And
amazing.
And it just went huge. It just went huge. But, again, it wasn't released as a single over here. But a lot of people over here, you know, bring it along. And, you know, I'm quite surprised that so many people have that single, actually.
Yeah. And I'm surprised when people over here mention it.
Yeah, me too.
Because... as you say, it wasn't released as a single over here, but a lot of people who know pipes enjoy it.
Right. Well, you know, you've got, let's face it, America's made up of so many Europeans anyway. I mean, all that music is all our music. You know what I mean? I mean, Irish music that I grew up on, Lonnie Donegan and all those people, they're all doing American bluegrass songs, basically. And, you know, and to this day, I love bluegrass. I love country music. It's very, you know, it's the instrumentation, the violins, the, you know, the banjos, the acoustic guitars. I love all that stuff. And a lot of that came from Europe, as we know. And it developed into another style, you know. So as the blues was sort of the black, you know, and jazz was the black thing, then all that other stuff was the white thing. That's the way I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But we were very much influenced by all American music because we used to get it from Radio Luxembourg, which is the American Forces Network in Germany, actually, after
right.
the war. And we got all that music, and then we messed around and did our own thing with it and then brought it back here, basically. That's all that happens. It was very just, you know, an organic thing that happened.
Now, talk a little bit, Denny, about the bust in Tokyo.
Well, you know, I mean, we'd been there 5 years before and not been allowed in because we were supposed to go at the end of the 76 tour. We were supposed to go in, and then we had our visas revoked at the last minute. And I'd had a very minor bust in England, as Paul had, you know, but even so, it goes on your record, and they just didn't want to let us in originally. And so 5 years later, we go back there, and then Paul, silly boy, takes some in, and he gets done. Well, I was standing. We've already been there for a few hours before, but the van turned up because we had to go and go through all the red tape as usual at immigration. But anyway, so I got in, and then I heard from one of the guys that Paul had been detained, and I thought, why? I didn't know. See, I was further. But, of course, once we got in, they still went through our bags. I was in the hotel having a glass of champagne ready to do the tour, and then one of the guys told me he'd been done, but I didn't believe him. I thought he was joking. I thought he was winding me up. So, anyway, there you go. So he was, and then we got we were asked to leave about a week later because of the press that it was causing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't want to be embarrassed by too much European press or American press. So they asked us to leave. Finally, Paul owned up that he did it, you know, took it in himself. So there you go. What are you going to do?
Yeah. Now, you ended up writing Japanese Tears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I felt for the audiences. I mean, the audience were... now been waiting for 10 years for it to go there. And so I ended up writing that song because of the audience that I knew was, you know, a lot of those kids were like so into Wings and everything. And I just felt a little bit bad for them. A lot of them didn't give their tickets back. They didn't return their tickets. They kept them as souvenirs, can you believe?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But anyway, Paul finally went there and made up for that. And I finally got in there myself a few years later. So everything's back to square one now.
Oh, Paulie. We hardly knew ye.
Oh, there you go.
So you also contributed backing vocals to George's all those years ago. I didn't know that, Denny.
Yeah. Well, George was actually... my first Beatle friend, as far as like a neighbor, and I used to, you know, hang around with him a lot because he was close by to where we used to live. Moody's had a house not too far away. That's when he was first married to Patty Boyd.
Okay.
And George and I were pretty close friends. And anyway, later on, when he moved and bought the big house, and it wasn't far from where I lived later when I had my own house. So that was another situation that I had him as a neighbor again. Well, anyway, one day, you know, Paul, we were asked to go down there and sing on a couple of tracks, that's all. So that's what we did. And Paul left, and me and George stayed a bit later, had a few laughs. And that was that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I've always loved George. I like him, you know, I liked him as a spiritual person, and I liked his music, and I kind of knew him better than anyone else. I'd spent more time with him until I got together with Paul, you know, with the band, although I'd met Paul lots of times and John and been out lots of times, you know, but we'd never really spent that much time together, whereas George and I were pretty close friends.
Right. Now,
I was pleased about that.
We're speaking to Denny Lane tonight. Now, in April of 81, you decide to leave Wings.
Yeah, well, you know, that was not a direct, but soon after the Japanese thing, because I knew that was going to give us a lot of problems working out the country again. You know, that's what happens with the visas, you know. So I had a solo album. I also wanted to live out the country because it was costing me too much money in taxes, like you do, you know.
Yeah.
I spent a bit of time out. And that all coincided with me trying to promote a solo album. Well, it's, rather than leaving, I just kind of, you know, drifted apart, really, and never went back. Just got hung up doing all that and living in Europe and stuff. We never fell out, nothing like that. But there was a problem. I wanted to do my own thing. And, you know, the Wings thing was a 24-hour job. That's the way I looked at it. And it just was getting in the way of me doing my own thing. But, yeah, there was a problem as far as not being able to work with Wings tour-wise, because it would have meant just going in the studio again. And we'd already done, like, two albums worth of work. I mean, I'd already been involved in the Tug of War and the Parts of Peace album anyway. And another album we worked on with the Rupert the Bear project. So I'd already, you know, done enough. A lot of recording work, and I was just getting tired of it. I wanted to get out and do my own thing, get on the road, really. So that's what I did.
Outstanding. Well, Denny, I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I'm going to let you get back to the Super Bowl because I know that's what you want to do.
Well, watching it, and then I came up to the house because we're down in the field. I didn't get very good phone reception, so I came up to the house to talk to you. So there you go. So I missed the end of it, but never mind.
It's been great talking about your legendary music career. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to share it with us.
Thank you, Bill, and God bless you all. See you soon.
All the best. Denny Lane, folks. I thank you for joining me tonight, folks. I'd like to thank my guests, Marky Ramon, George the Animal Steel, Rod Strickland and Denny Lane, my engineer, Brian Graves, who's one of my faves, and you for joining us. I'll be back with you on Sunday, March 1st, with NHL star Jeremy Roenick. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.